And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the show, we welcome our new contributor, Caroline Brader-Watts, in conversation with photographer Annie Leibovitz, whose work is now on view at the Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach through June 9th. Our film critic, Dan Hudak, will preview the 16th Annual Miami Jewish Film Festival, which opens tomorrow. Our first guest today has lived in Miami since 1980. He worked as an executive chef at the Paloma restaurant in Coral Gables, at Vinton's, and French Connection before opening his first restaurant, Cafe Vienna, in 1983. His other renowned restaurants and bars included the Pronto Pub in Coconut Grove, where he presented local blues bands, Mozart Stube, Old Vienna, Satchmo Blues Bar and Grill, and now Fritz and Franz Beer House, located at 60 Merrick Way in Coral Gables. Along with his culinary creations, he has been a champion of great American music. He is the founder and producer of many annual cultural events, and this year he celebrates the blues with the 15th annual Coral Gables Blues Fest, now underway through Sunday at the Fritz and Franz Beer House. Mr. Harold Neuweg, welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And that was way too long.
It's way too long, my friend. Meetings. Congratulations on you, on presenting 15 years of blues music to South Floridians. How did you come to love the blues so much?
When I arrived here in 1980, I got introduced to the King Mongoose Trot, a friend of mine, Jack Baconis, by the way, who passed away.
Jack,
great guy,
great bartender at Tobacco Road.
I called him International Ombudsman for Friendship. we met, and he brings me to the King Mongoose Trot in the Grove, and there's Fleet Starbuck on the last batch, and I was hooked from that day on. Fleet, we got good friends, and he started to play in my... Wherever I did bars later on, Fleet was a good friend of mine.
You put Fleet in the Pronto Pub, and there wasn't much room for the band. I think he was standing on the end of your bar.
Yeah, the Pronto Pub was as big as our dining room. No, it was very small, but, you know, there was... right next to the Playhouse in Coconut Grove, and we had, I think, 24 seats. Mm-hmm. So Fleet was a three-piece band. I had to set up between the door and the band. There was about, 4 feet. Half the band was outside. I think Mike, the bass guitar player, he was on the street already. Fleet played inside on the drummer.
He was marvelous. We miss Fleet Starbuck. Harold, you seem to be quite an uncommon restaurateur. Your culinary and cultural productions are quite legendary. You founded and continue to produce the annual Coral Gables Oktoberfest, now in its 19th year. You launched the first Paella Fest in 2007. That continues. And you started the Taste of the Gables as well. Where do you find all the energy to do all of this? Producing festivals is not an easy process.
I think I just love to be outdoors. I like to present food and beverage. I like to present good music. And it gives me joy putting these festivals into the planning and pulling through. The most difficult day is always the first day of the festival, to put everything together. But I have a fantastic support team by my managers. I have Charlie, who does the engineering for all the festivals now. We have organized every festival down to the last plastic cup or plastic plate. So I enjoy doing festivals. I enjoy doing live music outdoors. And I enjoy presenting the community with the kind of culinary stuff we have to offer. Is it Oktoberfest, or is it Paella Fest, or is it the Blues Fest? I just enjoy to do that, and it gives me energy by putting them on.
You bring us all a lot of great enjoyment with your cooking feats and your musical productions. You just concluded the annual Las Olas Blues Fest, the first annual. That was January 17th through the 20th, Party on the Lawn. And now you go to the 15th annual Coral Gables Blues Fest. Your Fritz and Franz Beer House is still up in Fort Lauderdale. Your beautiful Coral Gables location will be the host of the 15th annual. So let's get down to whom you have booked. You're introducing to us a number of new bands this year.
We started off last night with Deck 52, a regular at the Fritz and Franz Beer House, that did a fantastic job. job that didn't only play blues. They played a little bit R&B, they played a little bit of Led Zeppelin, a little bit of Jimmy Page. It was great. It was just really beautiful music. And inside we had the Eric Charles group, very good. A little soul, a little funk, a little New Orleans, a little Memphis. Great.
Wow.
Tonight we're starting off with John Leasy and Delta Funk, a band from New Orleans.
Oh, that's a new band
in the area. They're touring right now. We were lucky to book them.
And that starts at 5 o'clock
tonight. At 5 p.m. tonight, yes. The second band will be Bobby Stringer.
Oh, yeah.
We know Bobby for a long time.
Coconut Great R&B singer out of Coconut Grove, one of South Florida's legendary singers.
And I had Bobby as a regular at Satchmo 10, 11 years ago, and I said, you know, I have to get Bobby back.
Bobby's super. And now he's going to have his whole band with him.
Inside we have Juke, which is Eric Garcia, which is playing with a lot of other bands, but this is his own band now.
Ah.
And Juke has a little bit of electric rock in the blues. And that will be from actually it starts at 10, 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. Inside the beer house.
Bobby goes on at about 8 o'clock?
8 p.m., yes.
Things can ebb and flow time-wise.
Yeah, the blues. You know, if John Leasy wants to play a couple extra songs, no problem. We'll switch it around a little bit.
Saturday.
Pat Hunter. She used to perform at the Las Olas Blues Festival. Great show. Great stage presence. She is from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a great soul band behind her, and she has a fantastic voice.
She's living in South Florida
now? She lives now up in Fort Lauderdale.
Great.
And I enjoy her performance tremendously, and I was happy to introduce her to the people in Coral Gables. You know, this is somebody really we need to look out for.
Bravo.
Transition Blues Band, a friend of mine, they played at Satchmo. They play Friday nights at the beer house. And they bring a lot of people, which is important too for bands, to bring their friends, let everybody know. That's a good band to have on a Saturday night.
Now, Pat Hunter starts at 2 o'clock. The Transition Blues Band starts at about 5:30. And then, wow, the big guns.
Albert. I'm glad to get Albert Castillo back for this blues festival.
Albert's superb.
He grew up with me in South Florida. I booked him for the first one with the Miami Blues Authority. Mm-hmm. He played. And he was still on Alcazar, Mozartstube.
And
so,
then?
Glad to have Albert back. And then, of course, Ico. Oh, wow. Going to finish up the Saturday night.
Wow, that's a heck of a Saturday night, Bill.
Fantastic, yeah. I'm looking forward to all these things.
Graham's healthy and back on stage, and Ico starts roughly at about 11 o'clock. Sunday wraps up the 15th Annual Coral Gables Blues Fest. What's on tap?
Papa Joe's Blues Band at 12 noon to 2:30 p.m. By the way, Papa Joe loves the blues. He loves to play outdoors, and he loves to eat. So do we. We're going to serve gumbo. Gumbo on Sunday. And Papa Joe will make a special announcement that this is a special gumbo. So he will play at 12 to 2:30. At 3 p.m., we have on Eric Austin. Eric Austin is a local guy, plays blues, a little bit rocking and a little bit more heavy.
Mm-hmm. Chicago style, sounds like.
And then one of my favorite in South Florida.
At 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Ed, you say it.
Oh, Dana Paul and Dana Spinning Paul. Wheel. Yeah. That's his dedication to the great band Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Fantastic.
Wow, Dana Paul is a superb, another great South Florida legend.
Great show. If you need to miss the whole festival this weekend, please don't miss Sunday night. There's no football games out there. Come out. It's a free event. The plaza is open to the public. And you don't pay admission fee. All you have to do is buy a couple of beers to help us to pay for the bands.
Harold, providing that for free is so kind of you, sir. Thank you.
You know what? If we make the money with the food and beverage and we break even, I'm happy because it's a great event. It's a showcase for the Fritz and Franz Beer House and the bands.
Now you're bringing over to Coral Gables 36-ounce beer steins?
Yes, we do.
Oh, my. I'm on the floor.
That's a story. Okay.
I'm on the floor.
Anyone who has ever been out there at the Oktoberfest, you know, Germans do not like to have beer from the plastic cups.
Mm-hmm.
And they want
it tastes different.
Doesn't work. So what we did, you know, we couldn't give them glasses because people walk away because they're nice glasses.
Yeah.
So we started selling the beer steins. And the beer steins are 36 ounces. And we bring them in from Poland. They are made in Poland by an Austrian company because of the sand they use for the glass. So Poland produces them. We import them with a logistic company from Germany, Daxa, and we sell them here at the Oktoberfest. And people bring them back every year. Hey, I bought this one last year. Refill it. Perfect.
It's got your logo on it. It's beautiful, and they're tough enough to be clinked.
Clink. Yes.
Because a lot of that goes on.
They're not easy.
For more info, go to beerhouseblues.com. That's spelled B-I-E-R-H-A-U-S miamibeerhouse@blues.com. You can also email them at miamibeerhouse@aol.com or go to beerhouse.cc for more general information about Fritz and Franz Beer House. Harold Neuweg, congratulations on another great festival. Good luck to you, sir, and we hope to have you back real soon.
Hey, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, film critic Dan Hudak gives us a preview of the 16th annual Miami Jewish Film Festival with Ellen Wedner. Right now, we welcome to the show our new contributor, Caroline Brader-Watts. She'll be covering the Palm Beaches for South Florida Arts Beat. The Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach has a proud new acquisition, and Caroline tells us more.
Annie Leibovitz is a cultural icon who started her career in the 1960s at Rolling Stone magazine. She has since become the most celebrated and sought-after photographer of the modern age, capturing amazing images of such diverse subjects as Whoopi Goldberg, Tom Cruise, and Hunter S. Thompson. And her Rolling Stone cover photo of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, taken just hours before Lennon's death, was voted the best magazine cover of all time. The Norton Museum of Art in West Palm Beach recently acquired 39 of Ms. Leibovitz's photographs, and the exhibition is on view now through June 9th. I had the honor of interviewing Annie at the Norton Museum. Annie Leibovitz, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. Well, it is a thrill and an honor to be speaking with Annie Leibovitz, and in a beautiful setting as well. I'm right here at the Norton Museum of Art, where her wonderful exhibition is going on now through June 9th. Annie, number one, thank you so much for taking this time to speak with me. You were telling me that this is a little unusual for you because this was sort of a collaboration with you and Charlie Steinbeck, who works here at the Norton Museum.
Right.
Explain to us how this exhibition came together.
There is a show that's traveling right now that actually was at the Gettysburg National Park, and it's going on to open in February in Santa Fe at the George O'Keeffe Museum. So those are exhibitions to me. This is really an acquisition, and it was Charlie's idea. Apparently, I'd worked with Charlie at the International Center of Photography. One of my shows was derived from the book 1970-1990, was there in the early 90s, and I worked with Charlie there. So he always had in mind some kind of acquisition while he's been here at the Norton. And you know, it's pretty cool. It's pretty great. You know, for me, it's a milestone that I have photographs dotted around in museums' collections and, you know, the National Portrait Gallery in London, the Smithsonian, the National Portrait Gallery here in the United States. But this is a nice time for me that Charlie is so forward-thinking for the Norton, thinking about acquiring a certain amount of work. So he had been talking to me and some people who work with me for a while about a set of pictures that he wanted to acquire. And there's almost 40 photographs. So it was important to me that you had a sense of my work. And, Charlie had a very very firm idea about the portraits being very straightforward, you know, that the people were standing looking directly at the camera. And, I had the same kind of issue when I first had a show in 1970-1990 at the Smithsonian. One of my portraits of Pelé, for example, it's just his feet, the very famous soccer player. His feet,
right.
When he was a child, he played on the streets in Sao Paulo in Brazil. He had no shoes, couldn't afford shoes, and his feet were battered. And they were beautiful, and to me, they were a portrait of him. The Smithsonian had concerns that he didn't have his face, so how could that be a portrait of Pelé? So it's complicated. I really love very traditional, straightforward, you know, portrait work. In fact, that's, I think that's where my one of my biggest influences has been family photography. You know, family portraits, which is very straightforward. You see everyone. But you do something, you know, long enough, and, you know, there's nothing that says, you know, a portrait has to be, you know, someone sitting down looking directly at you. So, I think I like the rhythm. I like the poetry in looking at all different ways to do a portrait. But Charlie had this very, very fixed idea, and he came to me with a set of pictures. Actually, I wasn't even involved with it to begin with. I saw the original set of photographs that he was looking into, and, you know, he really did his homework. He went looking at, you know, Vanity Fair and Vogue and Rolling Stone, and, you know, honestly, those magazines have been vehicles for me. It's not really my work. My work is, there probably is a photograph in the shoot that wouldn't be deemed usable for the magazine, that is a great photograph, not a magazine photograph, right, and could be used, you know, should be edited and created and put into the books. And the books really are my work. So
this is really kind of a whole different animal for you.
This is a whole different animal, but but I'm trying to grow up and learn that, you know, it's interesting to have a different point of view on my work and have a different, you know, look. And here's the deal. The work is so, so big. I mean, I've been doing this over 40 years.
Right.
The work is so big. It's like, please, Charlie, come on in, take a look. What do you think? And, you know, honestly, last night at the opening, I was really surprised. I mean, it holds up. It's sort of, it's nice. There's no blockbusters in it. There's no, you know, Keith Haring or John and Yoko, and it's quieter and it's more contemplative. And, you know, I do think that the straightforwardness of it, that was Charlie's decision, does hold it together in some ways. It's strange. It's strange. I don't think I'm a control freak, but I might be.
Well, as I was walking through it, and it is beautiful, but I think what will surprise people is, because you are so closely identified with doing celebrity portraits, that there are not all celebrities in this collection.
I'm a portrait photographer, and when I started off working at Rolling Stone, you know, I worked there many years, and I was called a rock and roll photographer, you know, and then when I left Rolling Stone, you know, I you know, became known as whatever that is next. It does irk me a little bit. You know, what I think is so wonderful about photography is it is so big, it is so interesting. I'm a huge fan of photography. I actually collect photography. I think of myself, as I get older now, like a conceptual artist who has used photography. And I felt very comfortable in the portrait genre because it gave me a lot of freedom. You know, I at one time I thought I was a journalist, and I really tried hard to be a journalist. And I was sent by Rolling Stone to the war in Lebanon, and I went out with several wire service photographers one day, and I saw the AP or the UPI photographer, I'm not going to say who, you know, sort of set up a shot, you know, with, you know, some soldiers sitting along the side with their guns and everything. And I just said, that's it. It's all over for me. It's, you know, I mean, not over for me as far as what is journalism, what is not journalism, when is it real, when is it not. And, you know, by sort of calling myself a portrait photographer, I found that it had a lot of latitude for conceptual work, and you know, it gave you a lot of license to move stuff around and play with it.
So ultimately, it doesn't really matter what the person or its profession is, let's put it that way. If we're not going to call them celebrities, it doesn't really matter what they do in life.
It's interesting, you know, again, doing it this long, I mean, it's almost like, well, someone has to do this. You know, it is like, you know, who's the Karsh of Ottawa today or something? I mean, it's like, it sort of began to be, you know, like, how do we, you know, who else is doing this? I feel very responsible to my work. And, you know, I just did the Castro brothers for Vogue. And I went to do them, and I thought, well, who else is going to photograph them looking like twins? Like, they're, you know,
right,
like, who's going to do that? They're going to do this once, and it's never going to happen again. It's never going to, this is going to be a moment. And so I'm the one. I have to, you know, who else is going to take that picture? Because eventually they won't be photographed together again. They will, but it's not going to be, they're not going to sit for a picture. Sometimes it dictates, what you're doing in the sense of history. And I take it very seriously. What's great about it working for the magazines is I get, 30, 40, 50 assignments a year where I can glean maybe 5 to 10 photographs that seem like they're good for all time. And that's what I'm doing. I'm really looking for pictures, for all time. Yeah.
Take us back, if you would, back to the 60s when you started with Rolling Stone. Now, when Rolling Stone started and when you started with Rolling Stone, it was a different animal back then. It was certainly not the cultural icon it is now. It was thought of as counterculture. And as you said, you were thought of as a rock and roll photographer, but you're also a woman in the 60s. Were there challenges? Were there more challenges for you?
In the late 60s, I was a girl, not even a woman. I went straight from high school to school at the San Francisco Art Institute in 1967. I was a painting major at school. And, I walked right into the end of the Love and Peace movement, which was not as pretty as the beginning. It was the Vietnam War. It was kind of a difficult time. Rolling Stone was just starting. I was really lucky. I don't think they wanted to spend much money. They saw me as someone, no one else at the Art Institute was interested in going over to Rolling Stone. It was like, selling out. It's like, oh, you're going, I was sort of schooled in the idea that you did your work for yourself. You didn't sell your work. It was like you don't do work on assignment, which is really, honestly, that those lessons are what create my work, which is the struggle to try to do something good in a commercial landscape. I saw it as an open field that none of my peers were interested in. And, on some level, now that it's 40 years down the line, they were probably right. It's really hard to maintain some kind of integrity in a difficult, commercial landscape.
Was it like trying to break into a boys' club? Was there
any
issue?
No, I think I was lucky because I met the art directors right away, John Goodman and Bob Kingsbury, and they liked my work, and they just started giving me things to do, and they just kept giving me, more things to do. And Jan Winter also liked my work. And, I was so excited. And, I think there were a lot of advantages to being the girl taking pictures. No one really took you seriously, when you went out. And no one thought you could take a picture. And no one thought you were doing any damage or, And it allowed me to sort of move and take pictures and sort of be unseen. You were sort of part of the great unseen. You weren't, no one really took you seriously. What became difficult is when I became known after a while to still try to take good pictures in that kind of... Because the early work was really reportage. It was just sort of being there and going on the road, just sort of showing up and, no one changed their clothes and you didn't expect Jerry Garcia to, here, change that T-shirt. Now let's try a white one. No. Everyone just was like where they were. It was just what it was. It was a great school for me. It was a great school.
So, I think you might have answered my question, but at least in those days, when you're thinking about how do I photograph this person or this subject, is it fairly spontaneous then? Was there time to think ahead and go, boy, I'd really like to have him doing this and such, or was it was of the moment?
No, the early work was all completely reportage. I had no idea when I was supposed to go home. It's like, and why go home? Because there was nothing in my refrigerator. those were sort of like one shoot sort of went into another one. It was a life. I always had my camera. I always saw everything as a photograph, and I had no other life. It was I really lived for my work, and it was hard for me to understand when it was over and when it started. With each of these assignments, but what started to happen at Rolling Stone is as I was doing the covers, it became sort of like an appointment. Like Rod Stewart would show up at 2 o'clock, and he'd say, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I'd say, "Oh, I don't, I have, oof," it's like I was used to just sort of hanging around and finding the photographs, Cartier-Bresson, Robert Frank style, waiting for a photograph to occur. I mean, that wasn't going to happen. I did have to start setting pictures up, and that's where the conceptual work came from. And the conceptual work was really derived from real life. You know, it was based on something. I mean, what was ideal is go on the road with The Who for three or four concerts and, you know, watch them, just, you know, drink it all in, look at them, and then do a formal sitting with Peter Townsend and say, would you smash this guitar for me, you know, for the shoot? And he said no, and and then I said, well, here's one. And he said, okay, and he eventually did. So the conceptual, the setup, the portrait sittings really came out of real life, came out of, you know, they were ideas that came out of real life. She's so...
We'll rejoin Caroline Brader-Watts' interview with photographer Annie Leibovitz in just a moment. Please stay with us here on South Florida Arts Beat. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on WLRN. Ed Bell with you. We now return to the conversation between Caroline Brader-Watts and her guest.
I'm speaking with Annie Leibovitz. 39 of her photographs are currently on display at the Norton Museum of Art. For more information, you can call 561-832-5196 or visit norton.org. So now when you're doing a Vanity Fair cover or something like that, I guess there's a lot more time to be contemplative about it and to think about it.
Well, you know, it's a thankless job. You don't really want to do the cover anymore right now because, you know, magazines are all wondering how to sell themselves. And, you know, it really is akin to advertising. And there are a lot of rules and directives to it. And if the cover doesn't do well, everyone looks at you. You know, you don't really, you know, I love my inside work. And, you know, I don't mind occasionally doing, you know, a cover. But it's difficult. A cover is not a photograph. So it's, you spend a lot of time working on the cover and you don't really take a photograph. So it's really a different animal.
You seem like such a down-to-earth person.
Yeah.
Is it weird to be a cultural icon?
No, I don't think, you know, I'm a photographer.
You don't think of yourself in those terms?
I think that I've come to terms with when it comes to the coming up generations and I think the necessity to pass on what you know. I like that aspect of it. You know, when I go out to talk about my books or my work, I see the audiences filled with the women and the parents that and the men that are my age, and they're bringing their daughters. So I feel very I feel like it's important to set a good example. And, you know, being a mother myself with three young girls, you know, I find that it's important to set a good example. And so I don't think of myself as a cultural icon. I think of myself as someone who's done something for a long time, you know, over 40 years, and can maybe set an example, you know, because photography, oh my gosh, it served me so well. It's such a, I love what I do. And, you know, if I could pass on how much fun it is to do something that you love to do, I never forget those early days when I was, you know, sort of a young girl not really knowing, you know, which way to turn. You know, photography, walking around with a camera gave you a sense of purpose. It sort of taught you how to focus. It sort of let you go places you never would go, you know, by yourself. So it's a wonderful tool.
Talking a little bit about the nature of, and we'll have to use the word celebrity simply because it's a descriptive word.
But I know. We got to think of another one.
We need famous people.
you know what it is? I actually have thought about this a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, because the word gets used all the time. Well, celebrity, I mean, if you take the word apart, it's celebrate. It's really people do things well. you know, mm-hmm. you know, the people who we like to admire and
people of excellence
and all walks of life. I mean, I love to admire somebody. I mean, I love to think of them as one of the best of what they're doing. I remember I had this shooting with Carl Lewis, and it was the last time he was doing the Olympics, and I almost didn't go to that shoot, and I just thought I didn't have time to fly to Texas, and you know, it was his last. Anyway, I went out, and it was like he was at this moment in his life where you realize you really are like a medium. You're just there, and he is like at his place where he is, you know, won a certain amount of accolades, but this will be his last time. And he was at the peak of his physicalness, and of course he went on to. It was a quiet shoot, and it was, but you felt very privileged to be there. And then he went on that Olympics to win like nine gold medals. So, but it was his last Olympics. So sometimes you're there, and you're a medium, and you just feel really, really lucky. So yes, I do a lot of movie stars and, you know, actors, and but I really try to take care to make sure there's a great mix of, you know, all walks of life, that these accomplished people are coming from all different, you know, walks of life.
When you shot the famous cover now of John Lennon and Yoko Ono,
right,
and then he was killed just a few hours later, did it make you think differently about celebrity after that happened?
I think it had a very profound effect on me, you know, and it took me some time to sort of come to terms with what it was. It definitely was very unsettling to me. But, you know, I don't know how else to say this. I photograph people, and we're born, we live, and we die. And I can't tell you how many times I was supposed to be photographing Princess Diana, and I had a scheduled sitting with her in October, and I just talked to her on the phone, and then she got killed in August. She died in August. You know, I could give you a list, but you don't want to know. I photograph people, and it's part of life. Now, what is, you know, strange even to me today is to look back at that picture. And it is like, it's a Bob Dylan song. I mean, you look at it and you feed into it everything you personally feel about, you know, John Lennon or Yoko Ono or love or relationships. And you bring, every viewer brings to the picture or to the viewing of that picture, you know, their own, they project their own thoughts on it. And you get used to... you get used to that. I mean, that picture, first of all, would never have been the cover of Rolling Stone if he hadn't died. And it wouldn't mean the same if he hadn't died. You know, it changed. Its meaning changed because he was killed that same day. So, you know, yes, it is certainly, you know, I do like looking at photographs and having all kinds of stories in your head. You know, I do think if my photographs can sort of carry you away for a while and give you lots of ideas and thoughts, that's great. That's good.
Well, Annie, it has been a thrill to speak with you, and it's a beautiful
acquisition.
Whatever we're called. It is absolutely gorgeous, and we are so thrilled to have it here in Portland.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with photographer Annie Leibovitz. 39 of her iconic photographs are on display at the Norton Museum of Art through June 9th. For more information, call 561-832-5196 or go online to norton.org. This is Caroline Brader Watts for South Florida Arts Beat.
Caroline Brader Watts is the midday host for WLRN and also serves as director of programming for artsradionetwork.com. You can reach her at cfbwatts@yahoo.com. Special thanks to the segment engineer, John Watts. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment. It's South Florida Arts Beat here on WLRN. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Wrapping up today, our film critic Dan Hudak of HudakOnHollywood.com gives us a preview of the 16th annual Miami Jewish Film Festival with artistic director Ellen Wedner.
What better way to celebrate the start of the 16th annual Miami Jewish Film Festival than with a movie dedicated to the ultimate song of Jewish celebration, Hava Negilah? The film, justly titled Hava Negilah, the movie, is a documentary that chronicles the history of the term and how the meaning of the song has changed. And it opens the festival on Saturday, January 26th at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. Other films at the festival, which runs through February 4th, include slices of Jewish life from all over the world. From Israel is Ben-Gurion Hosting, an animated biography of the country's first prime minister from the people who made the great film Waltz with Bashir. From Germany is Kaddish for a Friend, which examines the actions of a 14-year-old when his sworn enemy, a Russian Jew and World War II veteran, moves into the apartment right above him. From Australia is The First Fagin, which looks at the Jewish figure in history who may have been the inspiration for Charles Dickens to create a criminal named Fagin in Oliver Twist. A number of selections are from the USA, including Foreign Letters, about Israeli and Vietnamese children who become friends, and the closing night film, Divorce Invitation, a comedy starring Lainey Kazan, Elliot Gould, and Jamie Lynn Sigler, about a guy who wants a divorce and the wife willing to give it to him pending one very specific condition. With all this going on and then some, we recently sat down with the director of the festival, Ellen Wedner, to learn more. Ellen, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
I wanted to ask you about your opening night film, Hava Negilah, the movie, because it seems to me Hava Negilah has been around forever. Why did it take so long for there to be a movie made about it?
Well, I think sometimes it's the obvious. Hava Negilah is part of our everyday life, not just Jewish. I mean, first of all, in this film, you'll see it being played in Russia, in Thailand, in Indonesia, in India, all over the world. And I think it's like a bagel. Sometimes people don't even realize it's Jewish. And it's just a fun movie. And it started life, if you will, as a very serious hymn that was sung by very religious Jews. And then over the years, it became very synonymous with the State of Israel. And now I think it's very synonymous with North American Jewry. And now it's every wedding, every bar mitzvah, every celebration, the 4th of July, whatever. We do Hava Negilah.
I wanted to ask you about Jewish-themed films, just kind of in general. Obviously, when you're programming the festival, you see a lot and you're only able to program certain slots. In general, the selections for quality Jewish-themed cinema, is that increasing? Is it improving through the years? Because you've been doing this a long time.
I have.
Or are the pickings getting more sparse?
Well, the pickings are changing. This is my 10th year as festival director. And it's very interesting because films are coming from different countries. It used to be more European. And now I think we're seeing Israelis dealing with, of course, there's Israeli cinema, but dealing with their past in a different way. You never saw films about the Holocaust from Israel. Hmm. You saw that from Europe. But now younger Israelis, like so many other people, are questioning, where did my grandparents come from? Why does no one ever talk about it? And so, you know, people make films about what's on their mind. We have a film, 400 Miles to Freedom. That film's about Jews of color. That's by an Ethiopian Jew who now lives in New York. So I think there's more to choose from. I'm lucky. I do this in a great city for a very diverse population. So I can bring things like The Chosen Island by a Cuban filmmaker who now lives in Miami about Sephardic Jews in Cuba. I can bring about Jews of color. I can bring a film from Australia and Israel, The First Fagin, about what Charles Dickens maybe based Fagin on, a real-life person in Jewish history from London. So I look at what's available and what matches South Florida.
And a few weeks ago, you had an evening that discussed Jews in China. But tell us more about The Chosen Island, because this is Jewry in Cuba, which is not something people naturally assume is a big part of what's there in Cuba.
Well, I think this is probably one of our most interesting films because That's exactly it, Dan. We are talking about young people who have returned to Judaism. There's that whole period of time right after the revolution when people just sort of negated religion in general. And then, of course, the Pope made his historic visit to Cuba. And religion in general opened up. And people that were Jewish that knew that for some reason their parents lit the candles on Friday night, but they didn't know why, they started exploring that. This film is made by a young man, Yasel Iglesias, who's going to be with us, who now lives in Miami, the film director. He's not even Jewish. He became fascinated with the history of Sephardic, which is the Jews that are from Mediterranean and Middle East and all of that area, South America. He was very fascinated with that, and so he's made a film about it.
Hmm. Also, tell me about The Lovely Sister from Israel. It won a couple Israeli Academy Awards. A lot of exciting stuff in your programming this year.
Well, thank you. Again, trying to be diverse. This is another Sephardic film. It's based on a Jewish Moroccan folktale. And the two actresses who are the sisters of the title won Israeli Academy Awards for the film. So it's a little bit mystical, a little bit magical, and somewhat based in reality. So I think it's a sort of different take from some of the other films we have, like Room 514 or Kaddish for a Friend, real-life situations.
It just so happens that this year the festival includes, the dates of the festival include Sunday the 27th, which is Holocaust Memorial Day, something really cool planned on that with The Last Flight of Peter Gins.
We actually are doing two films, Base of the Promise, which is about the Albanian Muslims who took Jews in during World War II. And the second film is a very unique film, The Last Flight of Peter Gins. It was done by Churchill Roberts, who is, I believe, a professor in Florida here. And Peter Gins was a childhood genius. And I think the film is so interesting because by the time he was 14, he wrote 5 novels and did much artwork. And no one knew the story except his artwork was on the Columbia shuttle, which, as you would probably remember, blew up. And his work became very famous. And I think it, in a good way, points out what has been lost by showing us a young genius who has left all his work. It was saved, but we see what we lost. And so it's a positive message.
Now, is it a documentary and is it animated?
It's all of those things. It's a documentary, and the filmmakers took 3 years to animate his story and his artwork. So visually, it's a very exciting film. And we're following that with two young musicians who are going to do a live musical performance of music that was suppressed or, hidden during the Holocaust. And they have brought this back to life. Two young local musicians are coming to perform.
Very cool. And the reason I ask is because also showing on opening night after Havanagila, or before Havanagila, I presume, is Ben Gurion hosting, which is about Israel's first prime minister, but it was done by the filmmakers of Waltz with Bashir, which was a fabulous, fabulous movie that came out a couple years ago. This is a short animated film, but it's definitely something I would love to see because I thought Waltz with Bashir was brilliant.
And I did too. Waltz with Bashir was very, very exciting film. This is exciting in two ways. This is, of course, his own words. And so we have Ben-Gurion speaking and his thoughts. But the animation is what's so exciting because there are so many techniques in each frame that you look at it and you just go, wow, I can see that over and over. And if you go to Israel, you can see it over and over in the Ben-Gurion Museum.
Okay, we have 2 minutes to go, so tell us quickly about Aliyah.
That is a French film, and it is, I think, a very interesting film because the young man who has a sort of troubled life in France is really thinking about should he make Aliyah, which is emigrating to Israel and making your life there, and it's about how he struggles to get there. I think a lot of these films, as this one so much is about Jewish identity or what is your identity as a person, and I think we struggle with that our whole lifetime. So I sort of look back now and say, oh my goodness, I picked all these films that sort of deal with identity issues. Letters to Jenny, an Argentine film, is very much about the same thing. Young girl, a teenage girl, totally different from a French drug dealer. But again, dealing with who am I?
And Numbered would fit into that as well, right?
I think. Numbered is a very, very unique film from Israel showing all over the world. I just noticed it showed in Singapore in the Jewish Film Festival. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is one. And it is about the numbers on survivors, the actual numbers. As we can all realize, people from World War II, the survivors, the servicemen, they're all dying out. And this was done by a still photographer in Israel. And visually, cinematically, it is so beautiful. And I think it shows how, as I mentioned before, young Israelis are dealing with the Holocaust and with their issues of identity.
Sounds awesome, Ellen. Congratulations and good luck.
Thank you.
The Miami Jewish Film Festival will be held January 26th through February 4th. Screenings and events are at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Frank Theaters at Intercoastal Mall in North Miami Beach, and the Colony Theater in Regal South Beach in Miami Beach. Fast passes for admission to all films are available in advance. For more information, go to miamijewishfilmfestival.com or call 888-585-FILM. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Dan Hudak.
Chairman of the Florida Film Critics Circle, Dan Hudak is a nationally syndicated film critic. You can visit him online at hudakonhollywood.com. Students, CultureShockMiami.com is your pass to the arts. Students can get discounted tickets to music theater, museums, festivals, dance, and more, including the Miami Science Museum, the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center presenting jazz vocalist Renee Marie all weekend, and the Gussman Concert Hall features Sunday afternoons of music events. That's the Gussman on the University of Miami campus. St. Martha in the Shores and the Coral Gables Museum. Visit CultureShockMiami.com for more event information. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our beautiful website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and thanks again to John Watts. We'd like to also thank our great contributors, Caroline Brader Watts and Dan Hudak. Call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your information to 305-995-2221 or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with host Joseph Cooper. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.